Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. Thursdays here at the Commonwealth Club, we tape for my show and Progressive Voices Network with my co-host, John Zipper. So, John, thanks so much for being the brains of the show.
I wouldn't call myself that, but it's always great having you here, Michelle.
Well, I say that because he actually hosts his own show. It's the week-to-week political roundtable talk, and he's the vice president here, or the boss.
One of the vice presidents. We have a gaggle of vice presidents.
Yeah. Well, we have a special guest for you today, and I've wanted to talk to her for a really long time, but I'm glad that I've taken some time to think about, you know, how or what questions I'll ask, and a lot has happened since the moment in which I said, wow, I really want to talk to this person. And that moment was when she gave a very tearful speech right before the mayoral election here locally in San Francisco. But let's welcome District 9 Supervisor Hillary Ronan. Hillary, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I had a very intense morning this morning. I have a six-year-old daughter, Mayel. And when I was getting ready for work in the bathroom, she was in the kitchen playing her little guitar and said, Mom, someone just walked into our house. So I ran to the kitchen and said, what do you mean someone walked into your house? She said, a man just walked into our house. And I, of course, freaked out because all that's in my head is Jamie Kloss. Have you been following that story? Which is a mother's worst nightmare. And so I called out and I couldn't see or hear anyone. I grabbed her. I went into my bedroom and locked the door. And then I asked her, did you really see someone? You know, sometimes, you know, our imaginations are lively. And did you see a real man or do you think you imagined it? She's like, no, I saw a man. And so I called 911 and the police came and they had to break down our door. And oh, it was one of those mornings and there was no one there. And so now I'm wondering, either someone has my key and came into my house and I just didn't hear or see them, or my daughter is having delusions, or she has an incredible imagination and feels no guilt about the fact that we had five police officers and a fire engine at our house breaking down the door. And so that's been my morning. And I think it's just illustrative of juggling politics and motherhood
and media and the news
and it's, you know, challenging.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in a very cultural Asian household, and so I was going to add one more to your list of who, you know, your daughter could have seen.
Yeah.
I grew up with my mom basically telling us that there are spirits all around us, and so whatever my imaginations were at a young age, I would always say, well, that was, you know, my father's spirit or my grandmother. Yeah. And anyway, I'm
possible
glad you're
my
okay.
Daughter has a sixth sense that I wasn't aware of. I'm just, my mind's been blown this morning. So we'll see what happens. But the good news is we're getting a new door and a new lock. Good. And so we will be safe. And I have to say that as a frequent critic of the police department, they were absolutely amazing. And I just feel so grateful, you know, and the importance of government, thinking about the government shutdown on the federal level, the fact that we have, you know, a place to call during emergencies, and they picked up immediately and walked me and talked me through it and kept me calm. And then that the police were right there and we were in the bathroom and with the window open, talking to the officer, promising he'd keep us safe. And I was really, really terrified because she doesn't make up stories like this. And so this is not in character. And so I thought there was someone genuinely in my house. Now I'm not so sure, but at the moment that I was barricaded in my bathroom and just the professionalism of the SFPD gave me the other side of the picture of how incredible these officers in the department can be. And as I said, someone is a frequent critic of the police department. It was, you know, at least a good experience to have had that very incredibly positive experience this morning.
Well, I'm glad you are, you and daughter are okay for...
Thank you.
Yeah, and you're here.
Thank you for being here.
And we'll dive into, you know, police and the Mission / Bernal Heights, Portola District, in which you are supervisor of. But I guess, you know, in my opening, I really would like to touch base with you and remembering that tearful speech.
Yes.
And that moment, as San Franciscans, we had this, you know, we had two things we had to do, which was choose a mayor,
yes.
but who the mayor would be. And then we came back to this big conversation of who owns San Francisco.
Yes.
We talked a lot about, I guess I won't bring up names, but, you know, corporate.
Yeah, Ron Conway.
Okay, sure.
And company.
Let's get back to that moment, because I think for a lot of us who are following on the media, we read what we read, we heard what we heard, and what was really going on?
Yeah.
That's a question.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the hardest things that I've done in politics, and I could talk about that for an hour. But you know, I was, prior to becoming a supervisor 2 years ago, I was a legislative aide for Supervisor Campos, my predecessor. So I had been able to watch now Mayor London Breed on the Board of Supervisors for 6 years, and I did not agree with a lot of her politics, that I felt like, despite her incredibly inspiring story and her charisma, all of which, you know, I continue to find incredibly impressive, that when there were opportunities to fight for systemic change in her community, that she often sided with the rich and powerful and not people that were being oppressed, including African American community. And that wasn't always true. Nobody has a perfect record. Everybody's complex and every issue is complex. But more often than not, that's what I saw. And so I was not supporting her for mayor. And I felt that if she was the interim mayor, then it was going to be impossible for anyone to beat her. I mean, when you're a mayor, you have, you know, tens of thousands of employees at your disposal. You have the newspaper following every word that you say and putting you on the front page. Again, she is an incredibly talented and charismatic woman, and so and leader. And so I felt like it would be impossible. And I really, really wanted Jane Kim and Mark Leno to have a chance, and there to be an equal sort of playing field in the battle for the mayorship, knowing that it's probably whoever won has a leg up for the next 10 years in the city. And what I felt we needed, and I still feel we need, was radical change. And I feel, you know, almost like we need to turn the city upside down, that it has, if we continue to go down the path that we've been going down, then we're not going to see many people of color or many working class people or many middle class people in the city anymore, that we're going to have the workforce crisis that we already have because nobody but the super rich can move here and can hang on here, is going to get worse. And that the things that brought me to San Francisco, because I'm not a native, the sort of progressive and innovative and visionary, accepting character of the city, it is disappearing, and I wanted to get it back. And I felt like if London Breed won the mayorship, that the chances of getting it back were much less than if Supervisor Jane Kim or former Senator Mark Leno won. And so I had to make that statement that day and say that I would vote for anybody but then Supervisor President Breed. And I felt like I had to tell the truth about that. You know, I felt like most of my colleagues stayed quiet. They didn't say a word, who felt the same as I did. The one person who did speak was Aaron Peskin, but he couched his remarks in about procedure, you know, about separation of powers and procedure, which were all true. And I agreed with what he had to say, but I also didn't feel like it was exactly telling people the truth. I felt like it was an excuse rather than the real reason why I knew he felt the same as me, that we had to vote for anybody but Mayor Breed. And I felt like we were going to pull the rug from under so many people that believed in us and the progressive cause, because we were kicking out from her seat an African American woman who had grown up very poor in as a native into the in the city in public housing, and had reached great heights, and that was a radical thing to do in many instances, and it wouldn't, I knew very well it wouldn't be looked upon very kindly, and but I felt like it was the right thing to do, so I felt like I needed to be very honest, and I think that will be the theme of this conversation today. I still feel that way, that we have to be honest with the public about what's going on, why we're making the decisions we're making, and be more transparent. And that's what I was trying to do that day. I do regret crying because, and that is the other theme of today's conversation about being a woman in politics. You know, I was told afterwards, white woman with crocodile tears. And I had felt like if I hadn't cried and if I had just been stoic, that maybe that would have cut back a little of that criticism. And I'm really going to try, honestly, not to cry anymore, even though I am an emotional person, when I'm in the board chamber speaking about decisions that I've made. The other thing that I very much want, the point that I wanted to make that day and that I felt like was perverted by the media and by the Breed campaign, which I understand it's politics and there's a lot of spin that happens in politics, is that I said somehow that she was a puppet. And I absolutely never said that. I don't believe that London Breed is a puppet. She is a strong woman who knows who she is and what she's doing and makes every decision for herself. What I said was that the reason that Ron Conway and all of these wealthy political interests were supporting her is because she supports the policies that they want for the city. And I completely disagree with those policies. And that got twisted into, I called her a puppet of rich white men and then installed a rich white man.
I wanted to get into that.
Yeah.
Talk about the visuals of it. That was
horrible, horrible visuals.
Yeah. I mean, the stuff that was going on behind the scenes, why not then put Jane Kim in?
Because she didn't have the votes. If Jane Kim, she was nominated and I can't remember. I think she declined the nomination.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but she declined the nomination because she knew she didn't have the support, if that was true. Either or, we voted and she didn't have the votes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be honest. I like Mark Farrell as a person. I am have very little in common with him in terms of his politics. And so he would have been probably my last choice. Mm-hmm. But what to me, the choice that I was making was this brief period of time, 4 months compared to the next 10 years, right? And so I felt like what I wanted was nobody to have an advantage with the media, nobody had to have the advantage over deploying city resources towards campaign ends. That's what I wanted for the next 10 years of the history and the leadership of San Francisco. And in exchange, we had to put someone in there to keep the city running for 4 months. And that was the decision that I was making, knowing full well that the optics of that decision were as bad as optics can get, knowing that the ramifications of that were that I was going to look like a racist, look like a hypocrite, be called a racist, be called a hypocrite, and knowing that it doesn't matter what people think or call me. What matters is that I'm doing the job to do what I believe is right for my constituents and for the history of San Francisco. And so I stood up and I told what I believe, what was my truth in that situation, and told very forthright what I was doing, and got a lot of flack for it, which I completely understand. I was ready for it. I knew what I was setting myself up for. I wasn't going in there blind, and I'll probably get flack for it for the rest of my life.
Go ahead, John.
Knowing how it then ultimately turned out in the general election,
yeah.
Would you have done the same thing?
I would have done the same thing, yes. Because hindsight's 20/20, and I think that now Mayor Breed, used what happened to her in a very politically savvy way, because she is politically savvy, and so are the people that worked for her. And I don't blame her for that. It's politics; that's what you do. I think it was an uphill battle for her opponents because San Francisco wanted her to be the mayor and what they think that she was and is. And so they elected her, and she was elected fairly. And now it's my job to continue to do what's right for the city, but to respect that she was fairly elected to her office of mayor. And I give her that absolute respect.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, we're going to get to the crying in just a little bit, because I cry a lot, and I don't think crying's bad, but, you know, it shows how much of a...
I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah, we're going to talk about crying. But first, I mean, I don't think that speech was wasted. I think that it did what you intended it to do, because the race was very close.
Yes, it was.
And so it like you know, the intention was to give an even playing field, and she was elected, and then now you're supervisor, and she's mayor.
Yes.
And a lot of, you know, what's been going on with progressive politics is it goes through the good, the bad, the ugly, and then it gets to a place where we all have to work together. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love to hear your perspective of working together, getting healing from that, moving forward, and where your relationship might be now.
Yeah. So, you know, there's not tension with myself and Mayor Breed when I see her or when we discuss anything. She's fair, forthright. We did have some really tense and serious negotiations around the minimum compensation ordinance that I and Sandy Lee Feuer were pushing very hard that she disagreed with. And when, you know, it became clear that we had the votes to pass that, the minimum compensation ordinance would give a raise to home care workers who care for the seniors and elderly, and nonprofit workers who work on city contracts, who are barely surviving in San Francisco, and a workforce that we rely heavily on to care for our senior and disabled residents, as well as homeless residents and youth, and all the incredible work that happens in the nonprofits in San Francisco. And Sandy Lee Feuer and I were fighting for a raise for these workers, who are mostly immigrants, women of color, low-wage workers, because they can't really hang on in the city. And the mayor was not ready to make that investment. And so it was a hard fought, you know, policy difference. And to Mayor Breed's absolute credit, she sat down with us, her and her staff, and seriously engaged in negotiations with us. And something I will be forever grateful for, because sometimes, and in the past, mayors will sit down with you and pretend to negotiate when they really have no intentions of reaching a deal. And what I could say is that is not what she was doing. She was sitting down with us. We were having really deep, really difficult policy discussions about priorities for resources in the city. And we reached an incredible agreement that will give home care workers and nonprofit workers, well, home care workers, it's slightly different populations, a $3.75 raise over the next 3 years, which is the biggest pay raise and largest salary of any home care workers anywhere in the country, which is something to be very proud of. And that will give a $2 raise to nonprofit workers. And then we held hands, you know, not really held hands, but stood there together in a press conference and celebrated that together and really recognized each other's effort in that. So, you know, I think both of us have proven to the public and to my colleagues and to each other that we're mature enough to have policy disagreements despite our history and despite our personal tensions, to have policy differences, to debate it out and you know, where possible, reach an agreement. So I deeply appreciate that. You know, having said that, you hear the rumors behind the scenes that, you know, she doesn't want me to be, you know, during the presidency fight, a president of the board, and that she doesn't like me, but kind of who cares? We don't need to be friends. We need to be respectful to one another and to be able to have respectful debate. And I think both of us have done that and have proven we're capable of that.
John?
Wasn't there a U.S. senator who said, if you want a friend in politics, get a dog?
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
But you do have friends in politics, and you have allies in politics.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure if I can go back, but how and why did you get into politics? You used to be a lawyer.
Yes.
So why did you decide politics is a place to be to make changes that I want?
Yes. I was an attorney and organizer with low-wage immigrant workers for close to 7 years at La Raza Centro Legal in the Mission District. And I would help workers, low-wage workers, get their wages back when they weren't paid correctly from their employers. And it was an endless battle. You know, we'd have case after case. We'd win case after case in the courts. But oftentimes we wouldn't be able to get the actual wages back. And it was very frustrating, and it was sort of endless. I could do this for my entire life and we probably wouldn't make a dent in the issue. And so I ended up writing the first version of the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights, which later became state law under former Assemblymember Tom Amiano. And through that process of writing a law so it actually worked for the workforce it was supposed to protect was an incredible experience. And from that, I decided, wow, writing policy and creating policy is somewhere where you can have a bigger impact. And when you know and work with and alongside the people that are impacted by that policy, it's a profound experience. And so I applied for a job with David Campos and ended up getting that job and working with him for 6.5 years and loving it. I absolutely loved being a legislative aide because you don't have to deal with as much with the dirty politics. You don't have to fundraise. You don't have to run for office. You don't have to go to endless events. But you get to work with the community creating incredible policy. And I'm a policy wonk, so I loved that job. And I would probably still be doing it today if there weren't term limits. But when David was termed out of office, and we both him and I had approached so many people that we believed in and trusted, mostly Latino leaders, because this had traditionally, or since David, you know, felt like the Latino scene on the Board of Supervisors, tried to recruit a bunch of the Latino leaders that we trusted and believed in and had worked with in the mission. We couldn't get any of them to run. And I had no intentions of running whatsoever. It had never been, you know, something I saw myself doing. It just wasn't my life goal or dream. And David and my colleague at the time, Nate Albee, kept saying, Hillary, you've got to run. You know, if we want to protect the work that we've done, you've got to do this. You've got to step up. You know everybody in the district. You've worked in this district for 10 years. You know how to get radical change done at City Hall. You've got to step up and do this. And it was a big decision for my family and I. And we talked about it and decided, well, look, I'm going to be out of a job. I, you know, am always going to work in jobs that are difficult because when you fight for oppressed communities, it's never easy, right? And so I knew whatever I'd do next would be something similar. You know, my husband's a public defender and an immigrant rights attorney, and he, you know, it's our family sort of role. We fight for justice as a family. Mm-hmm. And so we decided this was the best way for me to do it at the time. And so I ran and here I am.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And welcome to the dark abyss of all of it. But, I want to get back. You mentioned it very briefly, the board president situation.
Yeah.
And that was my other, you know, big question of,
yeah,
how did that go? And, you know, it between all the supervisors, right, after the election, it was a great big win for the progressives or, you know, liberals, if you will.
Yeah.
And so it just seemed like now's the time with all the Me Too and women elected, you know, in office in general throughout the entire country. We should have a female board president of supervisors, but that didn't happen.
No, it didn't. And it was very disappointing. It was a very disappointing process. You know, I think a couple things about that. I do think if I were a man that I would be board president right now. I really do. It's my honest to God belief. I believe that sexism and misogyny were part of this entire process, and it was brutal. I also think that there's stylistic differences, so that's not just sexism and misogyny, that there were multiple forces interacting at the same time. I am someone that is brutally honest, clearly. I am someone that has urgency to make radical change. And I push hard when I'm fighting for something. I don't mince words.
And if I could interrupt, do you kind of feel you got the Alexandria Cortez, I mean, that treatment of...
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. I find myself in good company. Not only do I find myself in good company, I'm inspired by what's happening at the federal level. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilan, I'm blanking on her last name at the moment.
Tlaib.
No, that's Rashida Tlaib.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley. I mean, all of these incredible women who are unapologetic about feeling that society is failing the majority of people, that we are going in the vast wrong direction, that this unregulated, unbridled capitalism has led us to a place of widening inequality and of, the worst healthcare system for the most, expensive care in the world, very poor public education system, the number of homeless on our streets rising every day, that everything really, climate change out of control and many, of our top leaders, including our president, not even accepting the science of it. I mean, we are lost and we are going in the wrong direction. And again, these women, they have the urgency and they want to tell the truth and they want to shed light and transparency on what's going on. And I very much, feel proud of being part of that movement that is mostly being led by women, in this country that I think is nascent and new and exciting. And that's how I act on the board of supervisors. And what was interesting about my colleagues is nobody questioned, are you a true progressive? Because my record speaks for itself. Nobody questioned the quality of my work. Nobody questioned my work ethic. Nobody questioned my competency. What they questioned, and this is where the misogyny and the sexism comes in, time and time again, was they criticized my personality. They said that I didn't have the temperament to lead the board, that I was too emotional, that I wasn't able to compromise, which, by the way, is bullshit. I just proved that I was able to compromise with the MCO, one of the biggest wins we had at the board last year. That, by the way, was stalled for 2 years before Sandy Lee Feuer, another woman, and myself got involved. So it just wasn't true. I also will say that I am a very nice person. I pride myself on it. You know, the quality that I'm teaching my daughter above and beyond everything else is you need to be kind and respectful to other people. Those are the two qualities, kindness and respectfulness to other people, that are I hold most dear. And it is how I treat everybody in my life. And so when they said, characterized me, and on the flip side, together with being kind and respectful, I am tough and I know what I think is right and wrong and what I'm fighting for. And so I am firm and I am tough when I'm fighting, but that doesn't mean that I do so without kindness and respect. And so I just feel like my character was maligned as an excuse for not appointing me president. And my colleagues ultimately chose a wonderful supervisor who, by the way, I respect and love very much, President Yi. So I don't feel like this is a disastrous result in any way, shape, or form.
They didn't appoint Mike Pence.
Exactly, right? I mean, Supervisor Yi is a wonderful human being who I believe has incredible integrity and is an excellent supervisor. So this was not a disastrous outcome in any way, but it did set a tone on the type of leadership that the majority of this board is looking for, which is not the, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez brand of the Democratic Party right now. It's the, more moderate Dems, more calm, slow, incremental change. And, I disagree. I disagree that that's the type of leadership that we need right now. I think we need bold ideas that will make tremendous change rather quickly, you know, relatively speaking. And someone who has the, you know, the passion and the urgency to get that kind of change done.
I'm losing my point. Sorry, go ahead.
We have about 10 more minutes until we open up to our audience here for your questions. So get them ready. Start thinking about a question if you have one for Hillary. There's so much that I want to talk about. You know, won't be a hog. I mean, your district, you know, the Mission, Bernal Heights, Portola, big, huge immigrant district, and people of color, and obviously maybe now, you know, a little bit of a mixture of high income, but definitely still low income to middle. I took some time out. It's been a while since I've walked the Mission in the general area, some time out on Monday to kind of just look at the changes. And so the developments are there. They're happening. So for you as supervisor of that district, to protect your constituents, the residents, I mean, the job's got to be tough, and at the same time, more than likely unpopular, as the city wants to move to embrace, you know, the changes.
Yes, yes. Great question. Yes, it's very difficult. you know, what I'm always constantly trying to do is walk the line of allowing change and new people to come in without displacing the long-term residents who've been there and the culture and the history of the neighborhood that makes it the special neighborhood that it is, which is what is attracting so many people to it. So, you know, there has been 10,000 Latino individuals and families displaced from the Mission in the past decade. Most of that displacement has not been by choice. Most of it has been forced upon people because of rampant evictions and just increases to rent that no one except the ultra rich could afford. And so how do we protect people who've lived for generations in that neighborhood and have such deep ties to the neighborhood that have created the cultural institutions, the nonprofits that serve people, you know, that serve the incredible food and cuisine and make the music and art. And, you know, how do we keep all that while understanding that in any major city, there will always be change and there will always be new people coming in. And that's a really hard balance to strike. And so what I'm always looking for with market rate developments that come into my district is, can we get enough community benefits and affordable housing out of the project that it would be better than not having anything at all? That's the question that I'm constantly asking myself. And I've, you know, mediated a number of disputes that, well, where we've gotten really robust community benefits packages, where my answer to that question and ultimately, you know, activists in the communities answer that question was, yes, this would be better than nothing at all. And then there are other projects where that's not the case. And what you quickly learn as a politician is you're damned if you do, if you're damned if you don't. And it's kind of liberating, to be honest, because no matter what you decide, you will be brutally criticized by a whole bunch of people. So you just have to do what you think is right. And you just have to constantly be pushing yourself to do your best to strike that right balance. And then we've tried to put in other protections in place, like creating the CAI 24 Latino Cultural District, which we're looking at expanding, creating a special use district to make it harder for the business owners to kick out small businesses and bring in new businesses that don't enhance the cultural district that we have on 24th Street corridor. And, you know, I've done every single tenant protection law I can possibly think of within the limits of state laws. And I'm constantly fighting for revenue for more affordable housing projects, which we welcome into the Mission District. We want every 100% affordable project in the city. Please come to the Mission. We want you, the whole notion, this whole debate between NIMBYism and YIMBYism, I just find it so false because it doesn't work in the Mission. The Mission saying, bring all your poor and disfranchised and homeless to us. We'll take the supportive housing. We'll take the navigation centers. We'll take the affordable housing. We just don't want the luxury. We don't want more luxury housing in our neighborhood. We want to maintain the working class feel and character of our community. That's the least NIMBY thing that's going on anywhere in the region, right? But when they say no to luxury housing, it has a very different feel than, on the peninsula, where they don't want anybody coming into their community because they want to preserve their perfect communities, right? That's not what's happening in the Mission. And we have to understand that difference and provide some allowance for it. But it's not what I hear when I challenge a project, based on the law as I see it. I am criticized as being NIMBY and not wanting to build housing, which could not be further from the truth. It's too simplistic. And that's what drives me crazy about the YIMBYs, is that they're just too simplistic.
John? I wanted to ask you about talking about women in leadership, political leadership. I wanted to ask you probably about the most powerful woman in the country right now, who yes. has the president basically held that debate. She's a progressive who is also known as being a very pragmatic person who understands the lines of power.
Yes.
Give us the political insiders. What's your take on her?
I love her. I love her. And noting that we have a lot of differences. Mm-hmm. If I had to compare myself to anyone or tell you who my biggest idols are right now in federal politics, it's Rashida Tlaib and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. It's the democratic socialists, basically. I don't know if Elizabeth would call herself one, but Bernie has, and so have the rest of them. It's people who think that housing and food and education and access to power should be human rights. They shouldn't be something that we're defining, and that we have the wealth in this nation to take care of everyone and meet their basic needs. And I believe that. I believe that with everything in me, and healthcare as well. We're going in the wrong direction. Having said that, Nancy Pelosi has just a career that's extraordinary. If I have to deal with sexism and misogyny in, 2019 in San Francisco, I can't even imagine what this woman has fought and overcome in her lifetime. She's a trailblazer. She made it possible for me to be so honest and forthright and bold, as I am. And she is bold. I mean, that letter, that sassy letter to Trump disinviting him to the State of the Union, I was jumping for joy. And I think she's inspired by the same women I'm inspired by. Honestly, it was in that vein. But I just have tremendous respect for her. Now, was her vote on the Iraq War something I agree with? No. Did it make me very angry? Yes. Do some of the corporate backers, of her make me uncomfortable? Absolutely. Do I think she's the most progressive person in Congress? No. But she's someone that I deeply respect. The last thing I'll say about Nancy Pelosi is that I've been at several events with her, and I've been at several events with many politicians. And the way that the speaker relates with human beings and the way she talks to normal residents in our community is with such care and genuine attention and love. And it's notable. It's not the like, let me get out of this conversation as quickly as I can, like many politicians. It's she asks real questions and she really listens and asks follow-up questions. She, again, her kindness and respect of other people are profound, and I deeply admire her.
that really leads me to, you know, because when we talk about Speaker Pelosi and before she was chosen as Speaker, and there's a lot of talk, you know, especially with younger folks of, okay, get rid of the old guard, bring in new people. We need new people. We need more radical voices. And, you know, what's happening here in San Francisco, and this is my personal opinion and perspective, it just feels like we're so, like we're fractured, like we're just, you know, breaking ourselves over a purity test or who's, you know, moderate, who's radical, who's more progressive. And at what point do we kind of look at it, ourselves in the mirror? And then, you know, going back to the whole honesty conversation and even with our cohorts, whether they look different from us, they're a different gender, and then all this, all these identities mixed into it, and then you want to support all of the marginalized, and it gets so rough. The conversation gets so rough and tough.
Absolutely, absolutely. I agree. There is a lot of fractured relationships in all, you know, in all politics. But for me, you know, the presidency fight was hard for me because it's not, it's the worst part of politics, right? You're advocating for yourself. You feel like people that you've worked so hard to support and said they were agreed with your way of seeing in the world stab you in the back, and you get so disappointed and all of that stuff. But it's not why I'm excited about the work that I'm doing. Fighting for and winning the MCO and a $3.75 raise for poverty-stricken home care workers is the reason I'm in politics. And so, you know, I feel like when you focus on the issues, that's where you draw people out and who they really are. I could care less about the progressive and moderate labels. I just think they're a bit something of the past, and we're stuck on them here in San Francisco, but they don't work anymore. It's not the same landscape that it was during the Chris Daley, Matt Gonzalez, Ross Mercurimi, Aaron Peskin days. We're in a different time now. And I often have more in common on the issues with, you know, Shimon Walton, who many people call a moderate. I don't think he's a moderate, but I think he's a progressive. But, you know, who knows? He's on that side of the aisle. I have a lot more in common with Shimon Walton, with what I'm fighting for, than with Raphael Mandelman, who is a supposed progressive, who I think is actually a moderate. So, it's absurd. And I don't, that's not how I work. I work on, you know, people who I believe that I can trust and have integrity, and then ultimately on debating policy and issues. And I think that's how we all have to start changing the way that we think about sort of teams in politics.
Yeah, and my question was really, you know, the Democratic Party, is the new Democratic Party, I mean, are we going to get to a place where we call ourselves a Democratic Party, or, you know, we're going to go into these sub-identities and things. But I think that you're right. The young voices, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they might kind of be changing opinions and attitudes. I mean, she kind of slayed. That's a millennial word. who was it? Joe Lieberman, yes. You know, in his criticism, and saying that she was more destructive for the Democratic Party,
which is hilarious from a guy who left the Democratic Party.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but
again, misogyny.
It's now time for your questions, and so I think we have a roaming mic. John has the mic, so this is a taping. Speak into the mic, and yeah, we'll start with Pat.
Down to brass tacks. About Pacific Gas and Electric.
Yes.
I'm really glad to see that you are supportive of public ownership.
Yes.
Can it be done?
Yes.
And will it be done?
Yes. I'm going to say yes. So just to catch everybody up in case not everyone's on the same page as Pat and myself. So we have a program in San Francisco called Clean Power SF, where the PUC runs a utility that provides 100% clean energy to its customers. There's clean energy, which is, you know, no GHG emissions and that don't come from fossil fuels. And then there's renewable energy, which is the best kind of energy, which is wind and solar, and takes no, does no destruction to the environment while it powers our needs. So we want Clean Power SF to move to 100% renewable energy and have enough of a build out in San Francisco where we have enough solar and wind power that we can provide for all of our customer needs. We, because of Clean Power SF, are competition to PG&E. We serve customers instead of PG&E here in San Francisco. We provide clean energy and when you're a super green customer, 100% renewable energy to all of our city municipal buildings, to many buildings that have a lot of city investment, like 100% affordable housing complexes, and then, you know, to upwards of 300,000 residents, and we're climbing, you know, and eventually get to all 800,000 of us. So that's the great news. Now, PG&E has not liked Clean Power SF and has not liked San Francisco because we're competition. And so what they have been doing increasingly, which is pissed me off and pissed the entire city off, all of my colleagues, is they have been holding up our critical projects like Garfield Pool, like a Randall Museum, like our a new police station, like several affordable housing projects, like a navigation center in the dog patch, by creating these ridiculous infrastructure requirements for power that aren't needed in any project of similar size anywhere in the country, in order to punish us for providing a clean energy alternative. And it has been basically blackmail, and it has been really angering all of us in the city government. Then fast forward to the horrendous tragedy of the Butte County fires. And fast forward to a couple days ago when PG&E gave notice that they will be declaring bankruptcy. I believe that we have to take advantage of this unbelievable moment in history that from tragedy arose an opportunity to take over the transmission of energy. So we produce the energy, but we are dependent upon PG&E to distribute it to customers. What I want to do, and I'm partnering with Supervisor Peskin on this, which is funny considering he fought my presidency tooth and nail. I'm working with him and he agrees on this, to take over the transmission lines so that we are completely divorced from PG&E. We no longer have to be blackmailed by them. We can advance our provision of 100% renewable energy to our customers and provide a safe, reliable, cost-effective, safe product to our residents without having a profit motive as our end motive. PG&E, we know, is beholden to their shareholders, wants to make profits, has, you know, million dollar salaries for their executives. That would not happen in a utility run by the city of San Francisco. The top salary in the city, which is high, we know, but it's $300,000. It's not $5 million, which is what the top salary is at PG&E. And they're, again, trying to suck every bit of profit out of operating this utility instead of worrying about the safety of their customers. And we've seen the impact of that. Sam Bruno explosion, the wildfires every season now. That would not, again, be a motive if San Francisco was operating utility. Our top motive would be safety, reliability, cost effectiveness. And so I believe we should be running and taking over the provision of this utility. And this is something that Aaron Peskin and I are actively pushing for and engaged in right now at City Hall. And I am optimistic that we can get it done. It's the type, again, of bold, urgent vision that we need, and not only because it's the cost-effective right thing to do in terms of providing a reliable service, but this is ultimately about climate change. We have like 12 years left, what the scientists say, before we're going to have, you know, very, very scary impact on the environment that's going to cause a lot of deaths. We have to be acting with, you know, to change the way that we operate as a species on this planet radically. And we aren't moving fast enough. And the biggest program that we have in San Francisco that impacts climate change is Clean Power SF. We need to be acting urgently to grow that program as large as we can, to grow that build out, to get more wind and solar, so that our impact on the environment and our footprint is much smaller. And this is the best way to do it. And I'm hoping that I can convince my colleagues and the mayor of the same thing. Of course, you know, this is clear as day to Supervisor Peskin and I. It's an opportunity that we'd be fools not to take. But we have a lot of work to do to convince our colleagues, and I hope you'll all help us do that.
Mm. Let me go back here first.
Hi, my name is Emma. I'm a constituent in your district, and I'm really happy to be here. I'm also a sexual assault activist, and I was wondering if you had any updates about SHARP, because I was so excited when that was initiated and passed last year, and from you.
Yes, thank you so much, Emma. So last year, aside from the MCO, probably the most significant piece of legislation that I worked on and passed together with a group of survivors of sexual assault and rape was creating an Office of Sexual Harassment and Assault Prevention in the city and county of San Francisco. We had a series of hearings. I had a number of women approach me who had been raped and had gone to General Hospital to get a rape kit and had gone to the police and the DA to get accountability, and all along the way had been treated horribly, had been blamed for their rape, had been not believed, had, and again, once again, this is in 2019 in San Francisco. It's mind-boggling. And it was stories that were just absurd, that, you know, things you that you would imagine having heard in the 50s and 60s, but I was perhaps naive, shocked to learn that that was still the embedded thinking, again, in our police department and our DA's office, and even at General Hospital. And so after holding a series of hearings where tons of advocates and survivors came and testified about their abysmal experiences dealing with the city, we decided that we needed a new department where survivors could go when they were receiving this type of treatment, when they were not given the respect or taken seriously by departments, and they'd have an advocate that could be with them every step of the way, demanding that treatment, documenting what was happening, finding out trends in ways that we're not on the front lines, and using the most trauma-informed and up-to-date practices in dealing with sexual assault, so that we could then make those changes, policy changes from the inside. So that legislation went into effect at the end of last year, and we are right now, it's housed in the Human Rights Commission, and we are on the second round of interviews right now for the director of that office. Once the director is hired, there's going to be three positions in their office: a director, someone who receives the complaints, and someone who works on the policy changes altogether. The director will be able to hire the other two staff, and then we're going to be up and running. And we already have many advocates who are ready to file a complaint and start investigating and figuring out what type of changes we need to be making in our city government so that we are providing the best care and the best services to survivors of sexual assault.
Wow.
We have a question here.
Yeah, hi. My name is April Martin Chartrand, and that's Chartrand, not Chartrand, like so many people say. I have been in the Bay Area since 1980. I'm 61 years old, just graduated graduate school. And as I have traversed the world of the Mission District, which was my number one stomping ground when I got here, because I come from a Spanish-speaking Latina background in Santa Barbara. So that was my home body.
Yeah.
The Cholos, lowriders, the Friday night up and down the street thing.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. My heart is broken.
Yeah.
My heart is so broken because I don't see a world where people are coming together. I see white folks over here. Mm-hmm. I see people of color barely struggling to get their 24th Street rent paid. Mm-hmm. I see people of privilege, dynamic difference, and education on levels on par just people like myself. Mm-hmm. Even though I have a master's degree, I still am a woman in poverty here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
what broke my heart is I went down 24th Street and the art, I think Galleria, whatever it is gone.
I know.
I'm a National Award winning artist. That place was my refuge. I found so much about Latinos in Mexico from that artwork there. Oh my God, what are you all going to do about this? Even you have Cali 24.
Yes.
I see, based on Boom Goes the Sound of Eviction, a movie, a documentary, you can see on free on YouTube, Boom Goes the Sound of Eviction, have all this stuff started in the 90s.
Yeah.
Willie Brown, Democratic.
Yes.
Jordan, Democratic.
Yes.
So Democratic doesn't mean anything when you have the same policies being put forth that got us here today.
Yes.
Displacement, lack of community, mental health issues, because you don't have community anymore.
Yes.
That's how I feel as a woman of color now. I live in another gentrified, colonized space.
Yes.
I call it the new Jim Crow of San Francisco.
Yeah.
People don't want to hear what I have to say, but that's what's happening.
Yeah.
I feel like a stranger. All my people along the Divisadero corridor are gone. Mm-hmm. My sense of community is gone. Mm-hmm. I walk in the shops, they follow me around. Mm-hmm. So could you please tell me, what is happening with 24th Street when we're losing cultural markers of what keeps us whole here?
Yes.
Please tell me what you're going to do.
Yes, yes. Thank you for that beautiful description of the reality of what's happening on the street and the difficult situation that we're dealing with. Galleria de la Raza was one of my biggest disappointments and heartbreaks this year as well. We negotiated hard with the landlord, and he was unwilling to budge. Galleria was incredibly brave during the process. It was able to bend so much. This, by the way, Galleria de la Raza is the premier Chicano gallery in the entire nation. It's one of the first and oldest, and it is producing sort of the most cutting edge, innovative Latino art in the country. And so losing Galleria de la Raza, which was one of the sort of anchor agencies that make Calle 24 what it is, was basically evicted, was forcibly evicted. The good news is they have a new spot on Valencia Street. So it's heartbreaking, but they're still in the mission, which is really important to me. The other good news is that we just landmarked that building as a historical site yesterday at the Historic Preservation Commission, or we just initiated the process to do that, which means that that landlord is going to have to only allow another gallery in there and won't be able to profit through the moon off kicking out Galleria de la Raza. And that is an important matter of justice for me, and also an important matter of recognizing the historical importance of that site. And you described it way better than I ever will be able to. Fourth, the Valencia Street site is a temporary site. We are building a permanent site on 16th Street, which isn't Calle 24, but it is another important corridor of activity in the Latino community and in communities of color in the Mission District. That is going to be much more vibrant and much stronger because Galleria will be there. That project is going to break ground soon. Galleria will be the storefront. And then on top of that, we're going to have hundreds of units of affordable housing, so which you should apply for. Please apply for it, because we do have, to Mayor Breed's credit, the favorite piece of legislation that she ever worked on for me, one that I agreed with 100%, was the neighborhood preference legislation, which allows communities that have been displaced and kicked out to have preference when new affordable housing comes online for those units of affordable housing. So thank you, Mary Breen, for that piece of legislation. That means someone who has a tie and has been kicked out of the Mission District has a real chance in that lottery of getting those new units that are coming online. So there is good news in the future of Galleria de la Raza, but we weren't able to stop its eviction on 24th Street. And that was a blow to all of us. And you know, what I'm continuing to doing, you know, thank you to the voters for passing Proposition F on the ballot, which is created a set aside for cultural districts like Calle 24 to have access to funds every year, which they can use to try to help save spaces like Galería La Raza. We didn't have it in time to save Galería, but hopefully for the next time that this happens, for one of those, you know, critically important organizations on Calle 24, El Tecolote, Presida Eyes, MEPI, Acción Latina, you know, there's still many cultural assets to protect on Calle 24 that we're going to be even more ready with resources next time around. So, you know, creating the cultural district legislation, putting Prop F on the ballot, fighting for the legacy business registry legislation. This has been all the ways that I've tried within my power to protect these small cultural institutions and small businesses that are so important to us in San Francisco. The problem is we need commercial rent control, and that's a statewide effort that nobody has dared touch yet so far, but that's what we ultimately need.
And there's the bell. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and so I hope all that you wanted to ask, you got your questions asked, but I'm pretty sure you can get a hold of Hillary.
Yes, somewhere, please, somehow. Contact me anytime. Hillary.Ronan@sfgov.org.
I want to thank everyone for being here at the Commonwealth Club and for participating during the Michelle Miao Show, John Zipper, and the Commonwealth Club. Of course, our wonderful guest, Supervisor Hillary Ronan. Supervisor, I do really want to extend heartfelt thanks. I encourage you to cry. I think crying is really healing. But I understand, you know, it's like a lion's den in there at City Hall and
yes.
Whatever.
Yes.
But I appreciate
it. I might not be able to help it because I'm a crier, but I'm going to try not to cry in City Hall or in front of cameras anymore.
But I appreciate your tenacity and your willingness to do good for our communities and our city. So thank you for your service.
Thank you so much. Thank you for this great show.
We're here every Thursday at noon. If you can make it, check the listings at commonwealthclub.org. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us for the Michelle Miao Show, your A through Z covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. We're here every Thursday live at the Commonwealth Club, and you can listen to past shows at
commonwealthclub.org/MMS.